Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. You're joining me from Belfast today for a special programme. My guest is Van Morrison. Regarded by many as a musical genius, Van rarely gives interviews. But today, he chats to us about his childhood, his musical influences, his greatest hits and staying creative. Hi Van, thanks for giving up your time to chat to me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listen, let's talk about your new album, I Have It In My Hand, The Prophet Speaks. It's your 40th album, I think. Your fourth in about 15 months, which is incredibly prolific. What keeps you being able to be creative? I mean, 40 albums, four in 15 months, that's a lot.
I don't really know, to be honest. It's just what I do. It's like kind of what I signed up for, you know, way back. And when I started this, you know, kind of signed up for this. So to me, it's like it's nothing new. I'm just doing it in a more more direct way. For instance, these two albums were recorded in a couple of days. Each one of those last two albums recorded in a couple of days. And then, I mean, it actually took longer to mix them, but we recorded them in a few days. So that's kind of the focus is much more like it used to be when I started. When I started, that's how we used to do it. You know, then after a while, I got into like more equipment, 2-track, 4-track, 16, 24-track, 48-track, all this kind of stuff. So later on, it became all about the equipment and not about the actual performance. So this is getting back to where it's about the performance and not the equipment kind of thing.
You know? Which is probably what you love. You know, as with your recent albums as well, it's a mix of vocal jazz, bluesy R&B. It includes, I think you're covering some songs of artists that inspired you at a young age, people like Salman Burke, John Lee Hooker, Sam Cooke, plus lots of great compositions of your own, like Ain't Gonna Moan No More.
Yeah.
Do you like mixing your own compositions, for instance, with other songs of great artists that used to influence you?
Yeah, well, you know, I just went through my collection and there's songs over the years that I've always wanted to do. So there's some of the songs I've always wanted to sing, you know.
There was a lot of praise just reading critics of your Hooker's Dimples on the new album.
Oh, good. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been in my set on and off for a while live. Yeah. So just decided to do a recording of it.
Do you ever go through non-creative times?
I have done in the past, yeah. But, you know, you just have to go with it when it's happening. You know what I mean? Go with the flow when it's happening, because there are times when it's not happening. You know what I mean? It's kind of, you never know.
Yeah, but you are so prolific. You know, I live in Belfast a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. It's where you grew up. Do you think that makes you feel more comfortable and therefore are you creative in Belfast more so than maybe other places?
I don't know. That's a good thing to ponder, though. It's a good thing to ponder. I don't know.
I know, and I think everybody knows about your dad and his record collection, how much it influenced you. He apparently had one of the largest record collections in Ulster. I gather he spent time in Detroit in the 50s. So you grew up listening to people like Jelly Roll Morton, Ray Charles, Led Belly, Solomon Burke.
Yeah, but it had nothing to do with his American trip. That has to do with a guy here called Solly Lipsitz. He had a record shop in Belfast called Atlantic Records. So he had the records, and my father and my uncle used to go there, and they used to take me there when I was a kid. So I grew up around this. I mean, it was available here through this outlet. So that's how I was introduced to the music, basically through my family and this guy that had the record shop.
And you were about 10, I think.
Oh, I was younger than that, from when I can remember, 5, 6. I mean, as early as I can remember.
Where did he get his interest in music?
I don't know. I guess he just, another good question. I don't know. He was always interested in jazz and blues. So initially, I don't know where he got the interest. Maybe it was visiting this record shop.
Yeah.
Because this guy was known as Dr. Jazz. Solly was known, that was his name locally, Dr. Jazz. So he was like the authority on all this stuff, you know.
And a lot of the artists I interview, like writers, musicians, they often look back on their parents now as they get older. And I know your dad worked in the shipyards, but he clearly had a great musical ear. Mm-hmm. But they often look back and think, if my dad had lived maybe a bit later at a different time, he might have had a different career himself, maybe even in music or something, your dad.
Yeah. Well, possibly.
Because people, I suppose, back then, they just worked, didn't they? Because they had to work.
Exactly. But being in music is, well, and that's what they wanted me to do too. I mean, I was pressurized to go work in a factory, which I did. I did work in a factory for a while. But the thing is that it's quite different being a professional singer and musician than actually just singing as a hobby or doing it.
Mm.
The business is quite difficult, and most people would not survive in it. That's the difference.
Mm.
Most people might like music, they might, but if they get in the business and they see what the hardship of it really is, they usually give up. So it's not really what people think it is. That's the difference. It's much more hard than people think it is to be a singer, for instance.
And to make a living.
Yeah, to make a living at it and keep going and be successful for, you know, throughout several decades or, you know, your whole life. That's a whole different ballgame. That's totally different than, you know, getting into it and then finding out, well, I can't, you know, it's too difficult, so I'll jump ship, which is what happens to a lot of people.
Mm.
They can't cope with it.
How come you can last at it for so long? I see
because I chose it as a vocation. They used to call it a vocation then, or a job, to be blunt. That was kind of the job that I thought I was meant to be doing. So, you know, I just followed what I thought would be the job. I didn't know about all the other stuff, about all the complications about the business later on. When I get into it, I was just in a band. I wasn't a lead singer. I was just a part of a band, well, several bands I was in before any of this, you know, took off. Being successful at it and then being famous, it's a whole different thing than just being a musician, you know. I mean, to me, there's no difference, but to, you know, well, the way it's perceived is it's different. You know what I mean? It's perceived as being something else. So there's like, there's professional musician, which is one thing, and then there's like the music business. So I almost coming from the viewpoint that I'm a professional musician and singer, not from the viewpoint of I want to be in the music business. Mm. Music business is what you get entrapped in.
Mm.
One gets entrapped in this because that's the way it goes, you know, on the various levels to stay in the game.
Because I suppose you can't be one without the other, can you? You can't be...
Well, not nowadays. Maybe you could back in the day, but nowadays, no.
No. And you dislike all that goes with that fame?
No, I don't dislike all of it, but it's not just me. I mean, like, people make this out like, oh, this guy, there he is, he's moaning again. It's like, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's not just me that's talking about it. It's like anybody who's successful in this... We all feel the same way. It's not just me saying this, like I'm a voice in the wilderness and I'm complaining about the music business. There's just been a bill passed in America where a lot of like famous musicians and singers are going up against this Spotify thing and people getting music for free. And this bill has been passed recently where, you know, the licensing thing and all that. So there's a lot of stuff going on that the mainstream media, they never talk about. But the music business has got like a lot of levels to it. There's stuff going on behind the scenes, but it's never reported. They only report the stuff that sells in the magazines, like everything's bright and shiny and it's all wonderful. But it's not like that at all in real life. So it's not just me that's saying this. There's lots of people in my position feel this way and they're saying this. It's a struggle to stay in it, basically. But nobody's going to tell you that. They want to tell you it's all wonderful and somebody's just going to come down the chimney. You know what I mean? So it's not like that in reality. But the mainstream media doesn't promote the reality of it. They only promote the shiny, bright part, not the dark part, you know?
That's really interesting, because I suppose that's very important for younger artists even starting off. Like, you have been so successful. The fact that you're bothering to say stuff like that, I think, matters for people trying to even make it now.
Yeah, well, that's it. There's no education about it because it's suppressed. Anything to do with the reality of it is suppressed. They want everybody to think of, oh, if you do this, then you become successful and that's it. No, that's not it. That's just the start. Being successful is just the beginning. And you've got a long way to go after that.
Your mum, Violet, was a beautiful singer, wasn't she? Is that where you got your voice?
Wow, that must be. But then you have to develop it. It's not just, you know, it's not just a matter of having the talent. You have to develop it, you know, and work at it. I mean, I'm still working, you know, still working at it. I'm still a work in progress, so, you know.
Your voice is still great, though.
Yeah, because I work at it. That's what I'm saying. It just doesn't happen by itself, you know. Mm. You have to keep working at it. It's a job that you have to keep working at. You know what I mean? So it doesn't really stop.
But you enjoy it.
Yeah, I enjoy singing.
You were an only child, I think, weren't you? Mm-hmm. So you're probably the center of your parents' world. Do you think that helped develop your talents or not?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, it could have initially because it was supported. So I was supported in what I was doing. I mean, with my first group, I used to rehearse at home and not bring the kids in, and we'd rehearse in the back room. So I suppose I was supported. But those days, you see, later on, Ireland is not like it is today. It's much different. There was really no music business in Ireland. There was no infrastructure, not even like anything like it was today. So everybody had to leave. So if you're from here, then automatically you had to go to London, or no matter where you're from in the British Isles or whatever in Ireland, basically everybody had to go to London. That's where it was happening. And there was no internet, there was no mobile phone, there was none of this stuff. It was just so you had to go where it was. And then you had to go through a process there of doing the work and getting where you wanted to get. I left home very early. I was kind of basically a teenager when I left.
Your first group, I think, let me hope this is right, was the Sputniks in 1957?
Well, that was a skiffle group, but that was when I was in school. That wasn't professional. But I went professional with a band we called the Monarchs. Mm. And that's when I went professional. I joined the Musicians Union. I was like 15. That was the band we were in. We were in a group before that. We're in, you know, we had a couple of different names. And then we ended up with a Monarch show band. That was the name. And then we lost the show band part and it just became the Monarchs. And we went to Scotland, went down to London, went to Germany.
The German experience was really important. I was reading something you said before last night, and you spoke about the idea of, you know, Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours to become an expert in something. You learned a lot at that time, didn't you?
Yeah, I read that book a couple of years ago, but I agree with him. Totally agree. You have to put in the hours. That's true.
And you did that, didn't you, in Germany with a group?
And before that and after that,
And still now?
Still not, yeah.
It was with them, Van, that you had the huge hit Gloria. I've seen you perform Gloria. You still enjoy performing Gloria, don't you?
Maybe I do at times. I don't know. It depends on the gig. But the thing is, that wasn't a hit at the time because that was suppressed because they put it actually on a B-side. So at the time when it came out, it wasn't promoted as I think it was Baby Please Don't Go was the one that was promoted, or another track, and that was on the B-side. So that wasn't really a hit when it came out. It just was over a period of time, over several years probably.
That's amazing.
In fact, other people had hits with it.
You also say you don't perform any song the same way twice. You try to avoid that, don't you? That's almost like a jazz
beat. Well, I automatically avoid it because that's the way I do it. So I do that naturally, do it naturally.
The songs, obviously, you released at that time, not just Gloria, Baby Please Don't Go, Here Comes the Night, they were your gateway to America. And was that always your goal, to go to the place where the music you had loved as a child came from?
No, I have no, absolutely not. I had absolutely no intention of going to America whatsoever, because my father had been to America and he came back. He didn't particularly like it. And I had like lots of aunts and uncles that went to America and they didn't particularly like it. They used to come back here and see them and they were homesick and they didn't want to go back, so I didn't have that kind of America's a promised land thing. I just, like I said, I was a professional musician, and then we started recording, and the management in London, Phil Solomon, he brought over Bert Burns to record several people. So we were one of several groups and singers that this guy was involved with, Bert Burns. He produced a couple of singles. And then he went back. And then so that was because I went to America because I was supposed to get a deal here with Philips Records. And there was a guy called Leslie Mann. He was a local representative for Philips Records here in Belfast. And I was talking to him over a period of time, and it was like nothing was happening. And I met people from the record company and all that. And I said, okay, well, when are we going to do this deal? This is when I was out of the group situation. So anyway, which was taking a long, long time. So meanwhile, somebody had seen Bert Burns, and I got a message to ring him because they said Bert started a record company. He wants to produce some tracks with you. So I called him up, Collect, and you know, he said, why don't you come over, we'll do some tracks, and I've got this record company. So I went to New York while I was waiting on the deal from this guy Leslie Mann from Philips Records. So I went there to do that while I was waiting. Things got very messy, so I ended up signing with Burt Burns' label. Then when Philips Records came in, you know, it's the old story, they came, okay, we're ready to do this. And I said, well, I can't because I'm signed up to this. So that's how it happened.
They were just too late at that time.
Yeah.
Astral Weeks, 1968, half century ago, as you know better than anybody. For instance, I was talking to Shane McGowan 2 weeks ago. I interviewed him for this show, and he played that title track. It's what he wanted at his wedding. He says he loves everything about it, the words, the instrumentation, the production. It's considered to be one of the best albums ever made. But it wasn't an immediate success either. Sure wasn't. You say at the time you were literally starving.
Yeah, that's right. And I was doing some of these songs live. I mean, there's a live tip floating around somewhere. It was put out on iTunes recently because I own it now. Someone else recorded this gig in Boston and they owned it, apparently. But then I got it and we put it out on iTunes to protect the copyright. So I was actually doing this type of thing before that. There's this mythology that all this kind of happened in the studio and everything happened there. And it was like, producer used to put out these stories that were like fabricated stories. But I was actually doing this before I ever went in the studio with these particular musicians. I was doing that before. So they had a blueprint of what this was even before I started recording it, you know? Because I had the concept. I was actually playing the concept live. I had I was on acoustic guitar, had a bass player, had a flute player, and we were playing this Astral Weeks type of stuff and some of those tracks live before I recorded it. So they already had an idea what it was. It didn't just happen on that day, you know, which is what the producer, you know, put out years later, you know. Yeah, I was just after I was sleeping on someone's couch in Boston, totally broke. Burt Burns died. He died, so I was kind of hung out to dry when he died by the people who took over. And so I ended up in Boston sleeping on a couch, then eventually connected up to do this album. And basically what I say about it now is, basically I was just a child, you know. I hadn't a clue about what I was doing. And it's very difficult to relate to it now because it keeps coming up, you know, but this is a great album and blah, 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 you know. And sure, that was, but that was that period of time. It's not relatable to me now. I'm not the same person. It's not that kid then. I was a very young person. That, you know, I didn't know anything about anything. I was just spinning off the top of my head, basically, you know.
Yeah, you were 23.
No, I was younger than that when I wrote the songs. Because I was already...
Of course.
This is like the third time I had gotten to these songs because I recorded some of these songs before with Burt Burns, and that didn't work out. And I recorded some with another engineer that worked for Burt Burns too. So this was like the album that everybody knows and loves now was the third attempt at it. Plus, I was also doing stuff like that live before that. So this was over about a 3-year period where I was working on those songs. So I guess from very early, from like 19 to 22 or something, I was writing and rewriting this stuff that ended up on Astral Weeks. So was I 23 when I recorded it? It must have been, yeah. But I was still, you know, still like, I didn't have a clue what was going on.
That's really young. You wrote most of the songs in Belfast, did you, Barbara?
Well, I started writing them when I was 19. And I wrote some here, I wrote some in London. And then only one of them was written in New York, like one song.
It's an extraordinary album, though, and you were so young. It's been described as a mystical version of Celtic soul. I mean, where did it come from? You were so young.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. Because I wasn't analyzing it. You know, I wasn't thinking, where does this come from? Or, you know, not like nowadays, the whole process is everyone is analyzing this stuff.
Yeah.
But that came later. That, you know, the people weren't analyzing this that way then. But now it seems to be that everything is dissected and why did you do this and what does that mean? And all, yeah, we didn't know. I was just a kid. I didn't know. I didn't know anything. It was just, I was just spinning out basically, and writing what I was absorbing, things people were doing, people were saying, you know, for something that was in a book that I was reading, and all this stuff was just kind of regurgitated in these songs. And there was different permutations of some of the lyrics changed over the years. It was like edited versions and then longer versions, and it was just what I was picking up in that time period. But that was a certain time period, and then by 68, that was all over. We were already sort of in the 70s, you know what I mean? By then it was emerging into the 70s. So it was, the world changed, basically, is what I'm saying. There was that time period, and then there was a giant change, like, you know, socially after that. And it kind of went back to closing down, like shutting down again. Everything opened up for a period, and then in the 70s, it all shut down again.
Do you think people overanalyze and over-dissect music?
Yeah, I think so, because I don't really think music is to be talked about, you know, really. And I don't need to dissect it. You know, I just take it for what it is. If I get these ideas and, you know, I write them down and I like progress them and evolve them, and if they're, then I think, well, I should record this maybe, you know. Some of them I don't, some of them I throw away, but you know, this is just a process. And but the process is not, I mean, when you're doing it, for me, I don't really have to analyze it.
Your third solo album, I think, Moody Dance, came out in 1970. Was it your first million-selling album? I mean, could you finally eat after that came out?
No, I was still hustling then. Still hustling because I wasn't getting paid. And I signed a Warner Brothers' contract was through a circuitous route. Because, the guy that produced Astral Weeks, the producer, well, the executive producer on Moondance, he was the executive producer on Moondance because I asked him if I could be the producer because he was never there. I said, seeing as you're never in the studio much, why am I not the producer? So he said, okay, well, you'll be a producer and I'll be the executive producer. So that was the deal. But they weren't giving me hardly any money. I was getting sort of a wage. You know, I was getting like $100 a week or something, just enough to kind of survive, but not survive very well. So that was they did a deal with Warner Brothers where they kind of basically gave away three albums for virtually, and today would be nothing. I mean, today if somebody did that, they'd probably be shot, but they gave it away for a couple of $1,000 or something, like, signed these three albums away to Warner Brothers, so that caused a whole lot of problems later on.
Did it mean a lot to you to be able to produce, though, even if you had him as an exec?
Oh, yeah, because then I had more. But the only way I could get paid, because I wasn't getting any money, you see, so I had to, I joined the musicians union, and they had a union for singers. So the only way I could get paid was I joined, it's called AGVA. It's like a union for if you're a session singer. So the only way I could get paid was if I was a session singer on my own record. Well, so I was the lead singer, but I had to get paid as a session singer, not as an artist, because I wasn't getting anything as an artist. So the only way I could get money is like, fill in the forms, send the forms off, and then they would get the money from the record company and pay. But it was very basic. You know, it was very basic. It was a session fee.
It's mad.
So that's what I was getting for those records.
Mad.
Yeah, no, it's mental.
Retrospect.
Yeah.
Do you think sometimes, when I was talking to Shane McGowan recently, he was talking about Rainy Night in Soho, and he was saying, sometimes when your hits are too big, they can eclipse your other great work. And sometimes he finds his big hits are a bit of a burden. Do you feel like that or not about some of your big hits?
No, absolutely, I do. Yeah, yeah,
you do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because I'm not there anymore. I mean, you know, I get kind of asked to do stuff, you know, that like people are finding out about now that I did when I was very, very young, and I can't really relate to it now, so, you know. So I did it then, but I think it gets in the way of doing new stuff, because then some people always refer back to that all the time, you know, For instance, there was one the other day, I did an interview. Well, I did a couple of interviews quite recently and last year where this thing about, like, Frank Sinatra comes up about, well, so-and-so's done Frank Sinatra, what do you think? I said, well, I did Frank Sinatra a long time ago, but you don't know. They don't know I was doing, like, 25 years ago or something, I was doing Frank Sinatra material. But now somebody else is doing it, so they know about it, but they don't know that I did it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so there's a whole broad section of work that I've done over that period of, like, what, 40 years, 45 years, 50 years. And a lot of it, people don't know about it, a lot of it. So that's... So when I play this stuff on gigs, they probably don't know that I've actually recorded this and it's been out there for a long time, you know?
I know.
That kind of thing.
Is that frustrating?
It can be, yeah. It can be.
Can I go back to 76? You performed with the band, Bob Dylan's backing band,
at
the last concert.
Yeah.
I think it was filmed as The Last Waltz.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you remember much from that night?
I don't remember very much. I just remember the sound check, rehearsal, and then I just remember doing it. But I remember it was a very slick operation because of the way it was being filmed, and it was all the schedule was very tight.
Yeah. Scorsese, I think, filmed.
Yeah, so there wasn't any room to, like, ponder it. It was just, okay, you're on now, so... It all happened very fast. That's all I remember.
Maybe there's a lot said for that.
I think so.
Yeah, as you say, too much over now.
Too much pondering.
Just do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're known also, I've seen you. You can lead a band, you're up front. You almost conduct them. So what kind of a band setup do you like working with best? You've said in the past you like two horns and a rhythm section best. Do you still like that?
Yeah, yeah. I find two horns to be limiting now, so I don't use that format now. It was getting limiting, and there wasn't enough space. So I don't have a horn section now, and it works better. Works better now.
You do almost like conduct your band, though, don't you? I've seen you like conductor.
Oh, yeah, of course, I have to, yeah. I have to at certain times up there, yeah.
Do you improvise a lot?
Yeah, I do.
All the time?
Well, see, some bands more than others. See, this is the thing, so... Just talking about this the other day, some formats that you have happen for a certain period of time, and then nobody knows why, but it seems to, like, peak at a certain point. You might have the same band for years and think, yeah, this is great, we're going to go to the next level, and then it peaks at some point. There's some bands that I had that could follow me when I did anything. So, for instance, on Too Late to Stop Now, that album, that band, I could do anything and they could follow me. It doesn't matter what it was. It was very psychic, and that's very rare. I think it happened again on the night in San Francisco. That band, that was kind of similar kind of thing where we could be very spontaneous and they could follow me and we could stretch out. And there wasn't a lot of reading music. They didn't have to rely on reading music a lot, and that's probably one of the keys, you know? And with Joey, too, with this... Joey, see, none of those guys have to read music. They do it the same as I do it. They're just doing it spontaneously, and they're not using music sheets, and that's the way we do it, so that's the way I like to work.
By October 73, you made a trip, I think, back to Ireland and wrote many of the songs for Veed and Fleece album. Some people say... It's your forgotten masterpiece. Got a little eclipsed by Astral Weeks, like Sinead O'Connor, Elvis Costello.
Right, right.
They say it's their favourite work of yours.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
Do you feel that it was eclipsed a bit by the, I suppose, brilliance of Astral Weeks?
Probably. I mean, I don't... I think the musicianship on Astral Weeks had a more of an edge on it. Musicianship. About the songs, I don't know. I mean, people are saying this to me now. I don't know because that was then. Yeah. You know, that was then. And I was in a certain space then. So if it is perceived that way, great. You know, that's great.
You sound like you don't really bother looking back. That it's almost...
Why can't
what's
you?
The point?
I mean, what were you doing then? Do you remember?
I can't remember.
I mean, most people I ask, they don't...
Yeah.
They don't even want to tell me, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I can't really get into where I was then. It's where I am now.
It's what matters.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's all you have. All you have is now. There's That's it.
Which brings me to a good question, which is, you've always been quite spiritual. A lot of your music sometimes has spirituality in it. Is it a constant in your life? I mean, are you almost like a Buddhist, like you're living in the now?
Well, as much as possible, yeah. As much as that is possible in the modern world, you know, with all the distractions of, you know, internet and all this, you know, and fragmented. The world's very fragmented. Well, you know, it doesn't take particularly be Einstein to work that out. It's a very fragmented world, so being in the now is harder, I think.
Do you meditate?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes. But that's not, you know, it's not like, hey, man, I meditate. It's like I'm not, you know what I mean? It's like something I've done all my life.
Yeah.
You know, it's when I did the TM thing. I think it was in the 80s I did the TM initial because somebody said, hey, man, this is, you check this out, you know? So I went along and I did the initiation. And when it was over, I said to the guy, I've been doing this all my life, you know? So I have. So I didn't call it meditation.
You recorded with the Chieftains in 88, Irish Heartbeat. Lots of people still love that. Was that an important album to make? Because I suppose you straddle everything that it is being Northern Irish, but I suppose that was almost being very Irish, recording with the Chieftains.
Yeah, well, I just wanted this like stretch out and a challenge. I just wanted a challenge. Also, I wanted to do a different type of music and stuff that I remember from when I was young, I was listening to. I just wanted to do something different and something that was a challenge. It was a great experience working with those guys, and especially Derek Bell. We really had a rapport. So that was really what the connection was Derek Bell and myself were able to make this kind of happen with the rest of the guys. And I wanted to do... I was also very... I was a big fan of Shauna Rita, so I was listening to Shauna Rita, and that's really where I got the idea, was when I was listening to him. Plus, I was approached before about the Chieftains, like in the 70s. Mm-hmm. In the 70s, I was approached by Garth DeBrin about doing a project with the Chieftains, but for some reason or other, it didn't happen then. So basically, it was must have been supposed to happen. This was in the 70s, but it didn't happen until the 80s somewhere, wasn't it? 80s, 90s? I can't remember.
88. You know?
But it was always somewhere in the background.
Yeah. You mentioned Shauna Rita there. Mm-hmm. He was a musical genius. Yeah. Hard to believe he died before he was 40.
Did he? You know.
So I know you love that, and you love the writings of people like Kerouac, but you also love Irish poetry, but you do like Yeats a lot. Have you been influenced by Yeats?
No, that's another myth.
Great.
That's another myth, because I was never influenced by Yeats.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I've read that in so many places.
No, I know, but they keep saying this, but I always say I wasn't, because there was a book out in America that mentioned me. There was a chapter that was linking me with Yeats. There was some similarity there. That's where that idea started. That's where it started. But I mean, you know, I like Yeats. I was, you know, great poetry. But he was never an influence. But I did do some of his work. I did Crazy Jane on God, because I liked that one. And there was another one, Before the World Was Made.
Yeah.
So I did. I like his material, but it wasn't an influence.
Good to clear that up.
Yeah.
Also, 2 years ago, I was lucky to be there. You celebrated here by performing two concerts in Cypress Avenue. People said it was a bit like Paul McCartney performing on Penny Lane. Bit of a cliche, but was it important for you to celebrate here at home?
Well, it was, because I mean, there was support for it, and it wasn't my idea. It was the East Belfast Arts, was their idea. It felt good, like kind of a homecoming kind of gig.
The sunshine.
Yeah, it was good.
You sang days like this for anyone, I suppose, any journalist like me who covered the peace process. The fact that it became almost the official anthem for the peace process, was that a source of pride to you to embody that peace spirit in your own country, that song?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
Were you surprised that that song became it? Like, it did become the peace anthem.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, definitely. But
it fit a perfect thing. You received your knighthood in 2016. Did that mean a lot to you?
I don't know. I'm trying to work this out myself. It was interesting from the perspective, like, finding out what this was all about. But as far as if it means a lot, I don't actually know what it means yet. I don't really know. And it hasn't changed anything. But I have to look at it from the point of view of apparently it was the people who wanted me to get this.
Mm.
You know, that's what I was told. I said, well, if it's the people, then yes, you know. So that's the way I look at it. But apart from that, I haven't a clue what, I mean, it hasn't changed anything. Who knows?
You're still performing at a hugely successful rate. Do you like performing as much as ever?
Well, it comes and goes. I mean, I like performing now, but as long as I don't burn myself out, and if I do too many, then, you know, I have to sort of balance it so I don't do too many gigs.
Mm.
Otherwise, you know, get totally, you know, burnt out, and then I have to leave it for a while. So it's like less is more kind of thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
You mentioned,
but the traveling is hard.
Do you find that tiring?
Yeah.
You mentioned Areadh earlier, and people talk about him as being a musical genius.
Yeah.
And people talk about you being a musical genius. Do you mind that label?
No, I don't mind it.
Mm.
I don't mind it.
If because can, you are, obviously.
Well, yeah, I think I am. But, that, you know, that can be a problem too. You know, that doesn't make it any easier, you know, because there's higher expectations.
Your music, it's really inspirational. People were saying when I was coming up today, mention Miriam, it's comforting. I found it very healing, some people say, at difficult times in their lives. Are you aware that your music does that? And does that make you happy? Does it give you a sense of real achievement that you have helped people?
Yeah, it does. But it's something I have to keep reminding myself of, you know. When I think it's really difficult to keep doing this, then I have to remind myself of things like that, you know.
And it's my final question, actually. Everyone has their own favourite Van song. Sorry to be really cliche, but I love your song. Have I told you lately that I love you? And loads of people say they fell in love to that song.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make you feel good as well?
Yeah, that's a good feeling, yeah.
Well, look, it's been a real privilege to talk to you today, Ben.
It's been
Thank
great.
You very much. And you've been so pleasant and nice, and I really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Ben.
Thank you.
My thanks and sound to Mick McLaughlin, to my producer, Shannon Gorman. We're actually back on Tuesday, Christmas Day morning, with Christmas with Miriam at 10 o'clock. So please join us then. Until then, Sláinte, and we go out listening to Have I Told You Lately That I Love You?